From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The impeachment trial of President Trump enters its final phase today, with both sides presenting closing arguments. Then there might be a contentious and drawn-out debate on calling new witnesses. But it's expected that by the end of this, President Trump will be acquitted. Joining us now is Ayesha Roscoe, NPR White House correspondent. And Ayesha, Democrats have been pushing for weeks for the Senate to call additional witnesses, like National Security Advisor John Bolton, a move Senate Republicans have resisted. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer this morning.
If my Republican colleagues refuse to even consider witnesses and documents in this trial, this country is headed towards the greatest cover-up since Watergate.
Ayesha, today, as we said, the president is likely to be acquitted. How has President Trump been responding to these developments?
Well, we haven't heard that much from the president. On his Twitter feed, he's still attacking Democrats, attacking Congressman Adam Schiff, who's been leading the House impeachment managers. But certainly his team is confident that they are going to get this acquittal. And the president has said from the beginning that he views this as a hoax. That's pretty much the way he's referred to all of the investigations into his administration and into his campaign. He has said repeatedly that he just feels like this is a sham and that this is a hoax. And so he will take this acquittal as a vindication.
I want to ask you about something else. How difficult has this trial been for the handful of moderate Republicans who've expressed an interest in calling new witnesses? I'm thinking about Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. Has the White House been putting pressure on her?
It doesn't seem like the White House has been overtly putting pressure on senators, but they don't need to, right? They don't need to explicitly say if you vote against the president, it will be bad for you. They know, the Republicans know, that this is a president who has shown over and over again that he is one to hold a grudge, and he is one that definitely remembers people who he feels like have been disloyal to him. And not only just the president, but this is the president's party. This is Trump's party. So the Republican base has made clear that they want loyalty to the president, and that Republicans who step out of line when it comes to President Trump, they end up out of office. And so they didn't need to really say anything. This is what they know.
You know, during senator questions yesterday, Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren implied that Chief Justice John Roberts had been diminished because of this trial by not calling witnesses. And thinking about the Chief Justice role, I mean, all the way back to 1868 in the Johnson impeachment, the Chief Justice did break ties and votes. What have we learned about Roberts this week?
The expectation is, and I say this carefully because no one knows what will happen if there
this
is a
true.
Tie.
This is true, yes.
But the expectation is that Roberts would not intervene, and that he is going to follow the motto of Rehnquist before him, who was over the Clinton impeachment trial, and that he is going to try his best not to be involved, that he looks at himself as someone who is there to help facilitate the trial, but not someone there to make these decisions, and that would be up to the Senate. But we do not know. He could theoretically make a decision or weigh in, but it doesn't seem that that's just not the expectation.
What do you think this means for President Trump on the campaign trail? He was in a rally in Des Moines, Iowa last night, blasting Democrats. Let's listen really quickly.
Can you believe these people? I got impeached. They impeached Trump. The best trade deals, the strongest military. I took care of the vets. We got choice. We got accountability.
He is the first impeached president to run for re-election, Ayesha. What are you thinking about here?
It will be this country is already very divided, and President Trump's base has already been motivated. If you talk to the Trump campaign, what they will say is that this is motivating people to kind of come off the sidelines, people who would back President Trump, that this motivates them. On the opposite side of that, you're going to have Democrats who are also going to be motivated because they will feel like the president got away with something and hasn't faced any repercussions. And so what you will see is a heightened, polarized electorate. We already have a very polarized electorate, but we're going to see whether that things will get even more intense now. But what you will see President Trump doing on the trail is saying that he won, he beat the Democrats, and that they could not, you know, get a conviction.
That's Ayesha Roscoe. She is a White House reporter for NPR. Ayesha, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Tanya, we heard Ayesha say just a minute ago, no one knows what will happen. You could also apply that to where I am today, which is Iowa, where we are 3 days away from the Iowa caucuses, and no one knows exactly what will happen. But maybe somebody who might is Kay Henderson, who's news director for Radio Iowa and joins me now. Kay, great to have you.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, and before we get to the caucuses, let's talk about the Senate impeachment trial for just a minute, because Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa has been pretty clear that she will vote to reject witnesses when there's a vote on that. She is also up for re-election this year. Do you think she's going to face any blowback from voters here in Iowa?
Well, I would just begin by saying Iowa is not Utah. If you look at the most recent Iowa poll data that's out there, the president's popularity among Republicans was 85% approved of his job in a poll that was taken here in November by the Des Moines Register and CNN. And actually, there was a 9% jump from March to November of last year in the number of Iowa Republicans who said they were definitely positively going to vote to reelect the president. Iowa Democrats had already been telegraphing that they were going to tie Joni Ernst to Donald Trump in the general election. So this is just something that I guess you might describe as a matter of degree.
Well, and President Trump was here in Iowa last night. He held a rally in Des Moines, went after all of the Democratic candidates who are going to be competing in the caucuses on Monday. Let's hear a little bit of that.
You can't do that, Joe, Sleepy Joe, but you have these guys, you have these people. How about Boot Edge Edge? Boot Edge Edge. They call him Mayor Pete. You know why? Because nobody can pronounce his name. Nobody has any idea. Boot Edge Edge.
Kay, do Trump's attacks on his potential rivals matter to the Democratic voters who are going to be going into those caucuses on Monday?
Well, as you and I have been out on the hustings here in Iowa, you've heard Joe Biden make the case that he's sort of, in his words, living inside Donald Trump's head because Trump mentions him so often, number one. Number two, the Iowa Democratic Party suggested that Trump's presence here so close to the caucuses might actually energize more Democrats to turn out on Monday night. They were already expecting record turnout among Iowa Democrats here. And then also, Trump's presence here was also about boosting turnout in the Iowa Republican Party caucuses. This gets lost a little bit, but Iowa Republicans will be caucusing Monday night. And so if turnout at those events is a fraction of what it is at Iowa Democratic Party events, that's something that the president would like to avoid.
Okay. We are just 3 days out. What is your sense of what's going to happen on the Democratic side on Monday?
Well, we have something really important happening on Saturday night. The Des Moines Register CNN MediaCom Iowa poll will be coming out. And the reason I mention this is because there's something called the bandwagon effect. People like to vote for a winner, number one. And so if someone is seen as emerging from this sort of packed group of four candidates that we've seen leading in the polls here, we sometimes call them the top tier candidates, I think there might be some momentum for that candidate. If indeed we see that Bernie Sanders has momentum and is sort of separating from the pack, I think that will sort of motivate voters who were supporting more moderate candidates like Biden, Klobuchar, and Buttigieg to really rethink who they might be supporting on caucus night. And we already had today the candidate who's been in the race the longest drop out and make that argument that he was dropping out because he didn't want to take any votes away from other moderates in the race.
You know, the other thing that we know is going to happen this weekend is that for the first time in days, many of the candidates will actually be allowed to come to Iowa because some of them have been stuck in the impeachment trial. That's Klobuchar, Sanders, Bennett, and Warren. Is that going to make a difference for them to have that at least Sunday to campaign?
Absolutely, because they will be able to make their closing argument in their own voice. This is going to be general election intensity weekend.
You know, one of the things we've been hearing is how energized young voters are, especially for Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang. Are they actually going to show up on caucus night in big numbers, do you expect, Kay?
It's hard to tell. Number one, you have to educate someone about the caucus process, which is a little bit complicated. Number two, they have to dedicate a lot of time. Some of them, if they have night classes, they'd have to skip a night class if they're a college student. Mm-hmm. And then I will just add this caveat that I've heard from a few of them. It's the day after the Super Bowl or the
right.
night after the
right.
Super Bowl.
That's
so
right.
if you've stayed up and watched the Super Bowl and been at a party, are you going to be willing to be out and about on Monday night?
There is so much happening right now. It's hard to keep track of all of it. Kay Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
I'm broadcasting today from Cedar Falls, Iowa, where many voters remain undecided just 3 days ahead of the Iowa caucuses. But even if they haven't made up their minds, there's no way Iowa voters could miss what's coming on Monday from TV.
We'll have highs in the 40s on Sunday, 37 for our big shining moment Monday, the caucuses in Iowa, and then the chance of snow really.
To talk radio.
They're trying to tag Bernie with the misogynist label.
To social media.
I came back from lunch today and Bernie Sanders door knockers had left flyers under my door. I got a Christmas card from Amy Klobuchar.
To ads.
That's a lesson Washington, D.C. could use right now. I'm Tom Steyer, and I approve this message.
And ads.
I've worked across the aisle to reach consensus. If I'm elected your president.
And ads.
Elizabeth Warren will be a president who works for you.
I'm Elizabeth Warren, and I approve this message.
According to political ad trackers, Democratic candidates and outside groups have pumped more than $65 million into radio and TV ads in Iowa since the start of last year, with more than half of that spending in the last 2 months. Donna Hoffman and Christopher Larimer teach political science at the University of Northern Iowa. They told me the campaigns are trying as hard as they can to target specific voters.
You're not targeting every Iowan. You're targeting Iowans who are going to go caucus.
Who are driven enough to go
exactly.
caucus. And are you doing that on talk radio? Are you doing that on TV, on internet, in the newspaper? What's your typical Iowan getting their news from?
Well, all the campaigns are going to typically do kind of a mixture of all of those types of mm-hmm. things. But each campaign does have a different strategy that they use. You know, for example, on our campus, in our student union, there is an ad now for Tom Steyer that is fixed above where the campus newspapers are. I've never seen a candidate do any kind of ad in Iowa like that. So he has a very different media strategy. He is buying ads on Spotify, buying ads on things that are that some of the other candidates are not doing. At the same time, if I go to my browser and I open up the Washington Post, I'm going to get a Pete Buttigieg ad. So the candidates have different strategies that they're using to try to get to the voter demographics that they want to touch.
Christopher?
You know, the likely caucus goer, well, or most Iowans are being completely inundated with ads. I think people are frustrated by the campaign ads. But at the same time, we know that caucus goers are notoriously late deciders. They make their decision in the last week or so. So, you know, they don't want to see any more of the campaign ads. But on the other hand, those campaign ads are trying to, you know, persuade voters to come over to their camp, voters who are – or caucus goers who are potentially undecided. And so they don't want to see the ads, but they're still trying to make up their decision. So there's kind of this back and forth.
How much do endorsements matter by, let's say, the Des Moines Register, which endorsed Elizabeth Warren?
They're part of the calculation. In this kind of environment, though, an endorsement from somebody you personally know, which could be a state legislator, but it could also be your neighbor down the street. Because remember that caucuses are precinct caucuses and precincts are neighborhoods. And on the Democratic side, when you go to caucus, you're going to literally go stand in the corner with your people who that are supporting the candidate that you support. There are going to be people there that you know. Knowing someone personally who may be advocating for you to come over to their camp can make a difference. So my neighbor Joe down the street, who I really respect and I know he follows things, and so if he's going with candidate X, maybe I'll consider that.
But Iowa voters aren't only relying on ads for information. We asked voters where they get their political news.
We get our news about the campaign primarily from the online news sources that we go for. We listen to NPR, the Des Moines Register, of course, Washington Post, New York Times.
My generation gets it from social media. And what that means is, like, I follow different news agencies, and then whatever shows up on my feed, I also follow too.
My Facebook feed is constantly full of news, and so I really do like to hear a variety of things, whether it's the New York Times and the Washington papers, both of them, both conservative and liberal.
Many also watch local TV news, which ranks highest on trust in the Poynter Media Trust survey.
Now from KWWL, this is the Steele Report.
And welcome to the Steele Report for this week as our countdown to caucus is...
Ron Steele is an anchor and reporter at Channel 7 in Waterloo, where he's been covering local news and the Iowa caucuses for 46 years. He told me he feels a great responsibility to inform his viewers who play such an important role in picking presidents.
Our station is an awful lot like the Iowa voter and caucus goer. We take the responsibility really seriously. In the way we portray it, we're not going to tell people how to vote. We're not going to tell people who to support. We're just going to try to give them the information that's available out there so they can make an informed decision. We take that responsibility really seriously.
How much of your newscast do you spend talking about politics in the campaign?
During the caucus year, a lot. In fact, we, almost for the entire year, we've had a nightly segment called Countdown to Caucus. Sometimes they're actually candidate interviews, sometimes just where they're going to be. And, of course, the main thing is to have them issue-oriented, and the issues in Iowa right now are pretty complicated. You know, luckily, the USMCA just got signed, the Chinese trade deal. Those are big factors in the minds of Iowa voters and some of those who will be going to the caucuses. I assume a lot of farmers will take the time to, you know, they're off right now because it's winter. They'll be there.
Do the candidates make themselves available to you pretty regularly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get a lot of candidates who will email me or call me and say, do you have a time availability? Would you like to be on, or can we get on your show? And yeah, and we've had a number. We haven't had all the candidates. We've had Steyer on. We've had Kamala Harris on before she dropped out. Hickenlooper, I had an interview with him. Didn't even air because he dropped out like 2 days later. Yeah, we've had Vice President Biden on recently. An interview that we did in a basement at Loras College in an old locker room. I just call it, man, one-on-one connection. The accessibility to candidates is amazing. They know it's important, and Iowans love that.
What is different to you about the way that people like you who are based here and the national media cover the caucuses and cover the politics?
We're a little less aggressive, I would say. Maybe that's the word. We're not actually looking to pummel somebody on every little word that they might have said 10, 15 years ago. We're kind of interested in who they are right now. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is so staged. The Iowa caucuses, we feel, are more of that one-on-one personal connection where you can really kind of maybe understand the soul of the candidate. Does that sound naive? I probably does. But we want to know who they are, who they really are on the inside, rather than the person who is just out there smiling and taking pictures. And well, let's take a couple of examples. Elizabeth Warren the other day was confronted by someone who actually questioned her plan pretty heavily about her plan to forgive all student loans. She did not handle that well. She kind of laughed him off. I want to say ridicule, but I think that person felt like his vote didn't matter, and that was not a good time for her. The former Vice President Biden was confronted by someone as well, a farmer, you know, and they got quite a shove.
He got angry.
He got angry and wanted to do push-ups. I don't think he did very well in that type of thing. Those types of confrontations, if you can use the word, they kind of really tell a little bit more about the candidate than we see in some of these staged events.
What do you think the national media are missing as they cover the campaign?
That's a good question. You know, Iowa is not just a flyover state, and neither is Wisconsin and some of the other states that actually went for Donald Trump 4 years ago. And sometimes I feel like I would like
to hear from some of the reporters. Do they really enjoy being here, or is it a necessity that they wish they could avoid? And I think they're really missing something, because Iowans are people who are welcoming. We've invited refugees here going back to the Vietnam time when Governor Robert Ray invited refugees to come to Iowa, and that many of them stayed. If I could take you guys a few blocks down to Hawkeye Community College, an educational center, you would find students from 40 nations in Waterloo, Iowa. And they're not students who are just here to study. They have come with their families to live in Waterloo, Iowa. Iowa is one of the first states to, you know, endorse and legalize same-sex marriage. I mean, immigration is a big thing. We have a lot of workers who come here, you know, from other nations and other states to work in Iowa. Iowans are very welcoming, and sometimes I think the national press misses that Iowans really are kind of Iowa nice. We deplore violence. We want equal opportunity for everyone. We hate discrimination, and we want to do what is the right thing to do, not just to win. Everybody in this day and age seems to want to win at all cost, no matter what. And we want them to do the right thing for everybody. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one.
And I will say that as an Illinoisan, I don't like the term flyover states at all.
It's not about us, though. It's not about us as Iowans. It's about supporting a candidate, the candidate that Iowans truly believe in and who's best qualified to represent that party as the eventual nominee. It may seem like it a little bit, but it's not a popularity contest.
Even if it isn't a popularity contest, it is a competition to see who can win the trust of Iowa voters, the kind of trust it's taken Ron Steele more than 40 years to earn. But then again, he'll still be here after the ads fade and the candidates have moved on to other states.
And we're following the spread of the coronavirus as the number of confirmed cases rise to more than 10,000. China is reporting more than 200 deaths. Today, Delta and American Airlines announced they will suspend flights to and from China. Here in the U.S., there are 6 confirmed cases, with the first person-to-person transmission announced yesterday in Chicago. Joining us now is Dr. Mark Dennison from Vanderbilt University. He's an infectious disease specialist with over 30 years of research on coronaviruses. Dr. Dennison, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
We're hearing on one hand that the coronavirus is not very deadly, killing about 2% of people infected, in comparison to SARS, which killed about 10%, and Ebola kills about 50%. So I think that's a bit of relief for people, but I know this is an evolving crisis. But it could be quite serious also, depending on how fast it spreads, and it seems to be spreading fast. Can you explain that a little bit more?
The difference with Ebola or with influenza is we have some really clear ideas about how it transmits, what the range of infection is, and what kind of individuals are most likely to have severe disease. The difference here is that this is a brand new virus in humans, and so its characteristics still remain to be seen. And unfortunately, we learn that as we go. The virus is unfortunately teaching us these difficult lessons as we move forward with it.
Right. And we're also hearing that symptoms could be anywhere between 2 to 14 days to show up, allowing this illness to go undetected. We're also reading the risk to most people outside of China remains very low, that the seasonal flu is a more immediate threat. How worried should people be that there are already 6 confirmed cases in the United States? Just to give folks a little bit of background on that, a woman who had been traveling to Wuhan had just come back from her trip and transmitted it to her husband.
Right. I think it's sometimes a false dichotomy to say, you know, flu is so serious, therefore we don't have to be worried about this. Mm. It's clear that we always should be taking care of ourselves and be worried about flu. But I think this is a new virus that we have yet to understand really how severe it's going to be. I think I'm at this point optimistic that it may be less serious broadly overall, and that transmission between people may not be highly efficient or may not occur very readily. That's good news. And I think as a general population, there is not a need for a significant worry in the United States at this time.
Doctor, you're really looking at this in a larger context, too, on how to fight viruses like this in the long run.
We are. I worked on coronaviruses beginning in 1984 because we already were predicting, even back in the 80s and 90s, that these viruses had a unique capacity for moving between different species. So we had been thinking about that even before the SARS epidemic, and certainly since SARS and MERS, we have been actively involved in NIH-supported studies to really try to develop antiviral agents that could block not just MERS, not just SARS, but we've tested it against other bat coronaviruses and other animal coronaviruses and shown that these drugs, particularly two different compounds that we've tested and recently published on, have the capacity to basically block any coronavirus that we test. And now looking at the sequence of this new virus, we would strongly propose that these compounds might be active against this current coronavirus as well.
That's Dr. Mark Dennison, an infectious disease specialist at Vanderbilt University who has studied coronaviruses for over 30 years. Dr. Dennison, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And while we're in Iowa, where the first in the nation presidential contest is just 3 days away, let's ask the key question. Why do the Iowa caucuses matter so much? Joining us is Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, take us back to the origins of the Iowa caucuses. How did they become this key element in Americans picking the president?
It's really Jimmy Carter's fault because when the reforms came through after the Democratic Party kind of imploded in Chicago at the convention, this unknown governor from Georgia came to Iowa thinking he might run for president. And we called him Jimmy Who at the time because we didn't know who he was. And when he came in basically second behind uncommitted, but the media said, oh, Jimmy Carter won the Iowa caucuses. And then he went on to get the nomination and to win the election. There was a kind of sense that there was something going on in Iowa that was really interesting.
And that opportunity for Jimmy Carter came out of the aftermath of the chaos of the 1968 Democratic Convention.
It did, because what happened was the Democratic Party said, we need more inclusion, we need to bring in more people, and they sent out word to all the state Democratic Party organizations. And here in Ames, Iowa, the chair of the Iowa Democratic Party looked at it and said, oh, my God, we've got to do all this paperwork. We don't have Xerox machines. We don't have faxes. We don't have the Internet. And if we're going to have a caucus and follow the rules and then send on the results to the next level, which would be the county conventions, we'd better start early. And the only reason Iowa is first in the nation is because Iowa said we got to do this by January. And none of the other states did. So what was first was basically the result of poor technology.
Now, we've been talking about the Democratic side. What about for Republicans? What was the first important Iowa caucus for Republicans?
Well, the Republicans really looked at what happened with Jimmy Carter and the media, you know, storm, basically. And they said, this is pretty good. And they got together, imagine that, and said, why don't we both parties do this at the same time? And 1976 was really the launching point. And after that, the Democrats and Republicans held their caucuses on the same night. The media came, the media center in Des Moines collected all that, and it became a bipartisan kind of collaborative thing. And New Hampshire joined in by saying, well, okay, we want to have our primary right after the Iowa caucuses. So 1 week after Iowa, we want to have a primary here, and that became institutionalized. And to this day in 2020, that's still how it's going to happen.
Has anybody become the nominee of the party without coming in, let's say, the top three in the Iowa caucus?
Nope.
Never?
I'm looking at right here at all the results from 1976 to 2016, which is the relevant time frame. I keep telling the media, I just did a huge interview with a Spanish language cable network, and they said, well, you know, who has to win in Iowa? Come in first. And I said, no, who has to come in first, second, or third? And it's not because Iowa has some sort of magic potion and it's water. It's because the Iowa caucus attendees tend to basically reflect pretty much the partisans in all the rest of the states, the people, in other words, who vote in primaries in other states. Iowa is not way out in some weird field. It's very much part of the partisan mood of the time. So when the Republican Party was more moderate, you had more moderate Republicans in Iowa as well winning the caucuses. And when the Republicans became more conservative, Iowa Republicans were also moving in that direction.
But does the fact that Iowa is one of the whitest states in the country make it not as representative as it used to be?
The answer is Barack Obama won the Iowa caucuses and would never have become the candidate of the party and won the presidency if he hadn't won in Iowa. And when mostly white Iowa Democrats, who, by the way, can be very progressive, decided Barack Obama looks really good, voters, I think, in the Democratic Party and the rest of the country said, that's interesting. And you know, what I always say is that if you had a place where the poll numbers were huge for, let's say, Cory Booker, then Iowa might be questionable. But frankly, this year, the poll numbers for minority candidates, who unfortunately have dropped out, were very poor in the rest of the country. And so Iowa, whatever happens on caucus night, I think, yes, you can make the case Iowa is too small, Iowa is too rural, Iowa has too few minorities and is too white. But the people that Iowans choose on caucus night tend to resonate well with voters in other parts of the country. And so Iowa doesn't really choose the candidate for president. It just sort of says, here are three people that we like in the Democratic and Republican parties. And you guys now go ahead, you guys and gals in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada and then Super Tuesday. Those are the states that really put the nail in the coffin, let's say.
But you get your momentum in Iowa.
Oh, you mentioned the word, the Big Mo. The Big Mo is because the media is crazy and they all come here and they come from every part of the world. I did a Spanish Basque radio station interview today. Basque. And the woman said, they've never heard of Iowa and they have no idea how that works. Can you please explain it for our Basque radio listeners? And so the media comes and, of course, reports what these candidates are doing, what they're eating. It's information that can be gathered in small settings where the candidates are talking to individuals. And it gives people in the rest of the United States more insight, I think, into the candidates than if they were running in a humongous state mm-hmm. with a primary and nothing but television as the medium for reaching voters. I think it's a nice way to do it.
Okay, well, since you've already explained it for the Basque audience, now can you, for our audience, do the thing that we have to do every 4 years, which is explain how the caucus works exactly?
It's easy but complicated in execution. The Republicans have a very easy system, which is on caucus night, they show up at their precinct and they show up and the Republicans come in and there are a few sort of speeches made. But then they vote on a ballot for their preferred candidate. The votes are counted and then the party reports the results from all of those boxes where the people voted. The Democrats have a really complex system in order to create opportunities for more diverse candidates and more participation. So you come in, you actually are asked to declare the candidate that you are going to vote for. And then the person running the caucus begins to count the number of people who said they're going to vote for, let's say, Tom Steyer, or the number that are going to vote for Joe Biden. And those candidates have to have 15% of the number of people that are attending that particular precinct. So there's a 15%, what they call a viability rule. And that means if you have 14 or 13%, you're not viable. And therefore, if you're voting for that candidate, you now have to switch and go support one of the others that is viable. And that sometimes takes a long time to do that. And then there is a mathematical process that I understand that Albert Einstein, when he heard about it, said, I don't understand any of this. It's the most complicated mathematics, because a graduate student from Iowa State University was put in charge of writing the equation for what are called delegate equivalents. And so on caucus night, what you're really getting is a reading of the mood of Iowa Democrats, or in this case, Republicans will also be there, and the record of their judgment in Iowa. 1, 2, 3. David Yepsen, who's a great reporter, one of the best in the world, I think, politically, once said that, you know, there are three tickets out of Iowa. You know, there's the first class ticket and, you know, the next business class, and then the last down by the bathrooms in the back of the plane. And those three have a pretty good chance when they get to New Hampshire of reversing the results. And so Obama wins in Iowa, but Hillary Clinton wins in New Hampshire. And then it's off to the races. I think that particular contest was fascinating because Obama and Hillary Clinton, of course, fought it out until the last delegate in either the Virgin Islands or Guam, I can't remember which, and he became the candidate and he became a two-term president.
That is Stefan Schmidt, who is professor of political science at Iowa State University, joining us to talk about the caucuses. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And you can hear all of our coverage from Iowa at hereandnow.org.
This Sunday, millions of people will be tuning in to Super Bowl 54 to watch the San Francisco 49ers and the Kansas City Chiefs duke it out for the championship title. The game will also reopen an ongoing conversation about the appropriation of Native American imagery in sports. Native American communities and allies are speaking out over the NFL's decision to allow Chiefs fans to attend the Super Bowl wearing mock headdresses and perform the so-called tomahawk chop. To talk all about this, we're joined by Vincent Schilling, associate editor of Indian Country Today and member of the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Thanks for being here. So this isn't a new conversation we're having. We've had this discussion about the Atlanta Braves and the Washington Redskins, but this is the first time the Kansas City Chiefs will be in the Super Bowl since 1970. What exactly is the history behind their name and their use of this mock Native imagery and paraphernalia?
Well, you know, I stumbled on it completely by chance when I was doing a story about cultural appropriation of the Boy Scouts. And in my research of what the Boy Scouts had in terms of this tribe called Miccosé, which is a false native, and I use that term very loosely, tribe that started in 1925 under the guidance of H. Roe Bartle. So H. Roe Bartle was known in his circles for his work that he had done as chief. He was known as chief and everywhere. And then he became mayor. He served mayor for two terms. And in 1963, Bartle, you know, kind of talked to Lamar Hunt to bring the Dallas Texans to Kansas City. And the name Chiefs popped up over and over again in a name the team contest. And Lamar's general manager had said years later, you know, I told him there's no way we can choose any other name than chief, which was the nickname of H. Roe Bartle.
So a mayor of a town with a fake tribe name then went on to help name the Kansas City Chiefs.
Yes, that's exactly right.
When you see the continued depiction of Native American people this way, or entire stadiums filled with non-Native people wearing headdresses, it really enforces, it seems, this savage warrior myth. Is that part of the controversy or the heart of the controversy for you?
Yeah, I think it is absolutely the heart of controversy for me, because taking something like a headdress, it's absolutely farcical, it's stereotypical, and it has nothing to do with honoring Native people, you know. And a lot of people tell me, well, you know, get over it. We're honoring you. My grandmother was taken to boarding school as a small child. Her mother was told, my great-grandmother told, you know, you have to get a job in order to get your daughter back. So she did. We got a job. She didn't speak any English. She only spoke Mohawk. And when she went back, the nun said, well, never mind. You can't have your daughter back. She's been signed over. So she had to go back in the middle of the night and kidnap her own daughters back. When my grandmother got old enough, she fled to California. And when she raised me, you know, she couldn't share her language or songs or values or traditions because she was too afraid that I'd be labeled as an Indian boy, could be taken to boarding school. And the honor that my great-grandmother did in taking her daughters back, that is honor to me. Mm-hmm. When people tell me that they're honoring me with what they're doing, if you want to compare that to what my great-grandmother had to do, I take issue with that.
The Kansas City Chiefs claim they are making efforts to work with Native communities. They actually have an American Indian Community Working Group, which advises on the ways the team can promote awareness and understanding of Native cultures. Do you think this is a step in the right direction?
I think anything that tries to encourage, you know, better behavior is a step in the right direction. But I feel like it's backpedaling, you know, and I certainly don't judge anyone who wants to take part of that and listen to what they have to say and this and such and so forth. But, you know, it's very hard when you see something like this and then you see the CEO of the Chiefs, you know, wearing a headdress on Instagram, you know, saying that he was once voted Cherokee chief for his church group, you know, and it's just it's a backpedal. You know, and I do like to say that I don't speak for all Native people, and I respect their views as well. I just personally prefer that they would completely change the name and get rid of all Native imagery in sports, period.
There's always been pushback from fans when there's a call to make real change. We saw this with the Atlanta Braves and the Washington Redskins. It could perhaps be rooted in a sense of guilt of being complicit, but ultimately it's tied to their love for the game and the team. What would you say to people, Native and non-Native alike, that are trying to reconcile their love for their team and the game, but also this painful and really made-up history that you're telling me?
Right. I think that's well said. And my response to that is that we as people need to be cognizant not to throw all of our emotions and feelings and reactions and connectivity into one place. You can have excitement for your team. You can have excitement in that camaraderie of your friends, you know, joining hands and saying, yay, they got it. They got a touchdown. Or feel excited about your favorite athletes who have worked so hard to achieve their levels of athleticism. But don't tie that into what the meaning of the name is or what the meaning of these stereotypes are, because it's not the same thing. This Native history and giving respect to Native people is a completely separate issue.
That's Vincent Schilling. He is the associate editor of Indian Country Today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.